Idea Brew Studios presents All Indians Matter in depth.
When I arrived at Birla House, a Sikh priest was reciting from the Sukhmani Sahib. I first visited the spot where Mahatma Gandhi fell. Later, I went into Birla House, which was plunged into mourning. I walked along the heavily carpeted passages to the room which had been Gandhiji's. Dazed crowds in mute procession passed by the large window, throwing floral tributes, mostly red roses, into the room, and then, placing their hands together in mute bewilderment, passed by his window and out of sight.
Hello and welcome to All Indians Matter. I am Ashraf Engineer and this is part 4 of our conversation on Gandhi's killing with Tushar Gandhi, great-grandson of the Mahatma and president of the Mahatma Gandhi Foundation. He's also the author of the book Let's Kill Gandhi, a chronicle of Gandhi's last days, the conspiracy, murder, investigations and trial. In part 3, we spoke about what the investigation into the assassination revealed and what happened during the trial. In this episode, we'll discover how the investigation was bungled and the outcome of it. Tushar, some clear lapses emerge when you look at the documentation of the murder and then the proceedings. For example, while Bapu had refused security inside the venue around him, why didn't the police post security outside the venue where they could look at people who are coming in, frisk them?
You see, one thing you must remember, Ashraf, is it's very difficult to protect somebody who refuses protection. That's the basic ideal from where we need to take this. And Bapu categorically refused to be protected. He said, God protects me, and if he doesn't want to protect me, then it's time for me to go. And I refused to accept the protection of mere mortals. So everybody's hands were tied. But having said that, when security concerns arise, the desire of the targeted person is never taken into consideration. It is the requirement which is of prime importance. Even if you see today, none of the prime ministers or presidents of India can refuse to be protected by the SPG, because it's an act of parliament and they don't have a choice.
And not only that, there are security implications for the entire country.
Yeah. And so the fact remains that the excuse that was made was that we were afraid that if we, you know, decided Gandhi and put security in place, he would go on a fast and we would be embarrassed and things. And so we did not do it. But in the investigations of the Kapoor Commission, it was revealed that immediately post-independence, the British blueprint for security for VIPs was customized to provide security for the new Indian VIPs. And there was a whole blueprint. And there was a blueprint for how security would be provided for Bapu. And also in that, the experts who had created that blueprint had created the scenario where Bapu would refuse security and still security would be provided to him without his knowledge. And it is an entire detailed blueprint that was submitted to the Kapoor Commission, saying that this was lying with the police. We don't know why they did not implement it, in which police dressed as the volunteers, the ashram volunteers, how they would be in, you know, the circles around Bapu, how they would be deployed, from where the armed policemen would be deployed and where they would be policemen carrying hidden weapons which were not detectable, and where there would be policemen who were proficient in unarmed combat would be deployed, and all that. There was a whole blueprint which was revealed by the police itself to the Kapoor Commission. But that was never implemented. It was never ever implemented, and it just kept gathering dust. It was implemented after the murder for the protection of all the other VIPs, not in the case of Bapu.
But Tushar, you mentioned the Kapoor Commission a few times already, and let's talk about the Kapoor Commission a little bit. So, first of all, you know, you mentioned earlier that there was a very clear mandate for the commission, and it was very clear that the commission could not step outside of that mandate. So, what were those limitations, firstly, and give us a couple of the notable observations.
See, the three purviews that were given to the Kapoor Commission to investigate was arising from that public meeting in Pune where revelations were made about the conspiracy and information and pre-knowledge and all that. And so the three asks for the Kapoor Commission was whether there was a conspiracy involved in the Gandhi murder, whether it was just a small city-based conspiracy or it was a nationwide conspiracy, and whether there was public knowledge about the existence of the conspiracy, and whether the government was informed about, or individuals in the government were informed about the conspiracy. This was what the Kapoor Commission was established for. But the Kapoor Commission took this brief and went way beyond limiting itself just to, you know, when they were asked to investigate whether there was a national conspiracy, they had to go into the entire national investigation. And so the information that was revealed to them, Kapoor Commission sat in five or six cities. They had their sittings, various sittings in five or six cities, which had some kind of a connection with the murder. And so in multiple locations, they conducted their inquiries and witnesses were brought in to reveal the facts. Documents were investigated. A huge plethora of documents was referred to by the Kapoor Commission and was presented to the Kapoor Commission also. So the Kapoor Commission went into the absolute nitty-gritty of not only the conspiracy to murder Bapu, but the broad-based conspiracy in existence at that time and the various players who were involved in those conspiracies and who were part of the murder conspiracy in particular, and all the police departments who could be a part of it, all the political players of that time who were in some way or the other associated with the murder. And very startling facts came about in the Kapoor Commission's inquiry. One of the things that Maniben Patel, Sardar Patel's daughter, revealed to the Kapoor Commission was that she remembered that 10 days before or so, 10 or 12 days before the attack, the bomb attack on the 20th, two young men had come to visit Sardar Patel very early in the morning. And Maniben had noticed that they were very agitated and very animated, and it seemed as if they were protesting with Sardar Patel. Maniben did not sit into the meeting because it was very early in the morning and she was just, you know, getting up and doing her morning rituals and things. So she didn't sit in on the meeting. But later on, she asked Sardar Patel who those early morning visitors were. And Maniben told the Kapoor Commission that he told her that they were a publisher and an editor from a periodical in Pune who had come there because they were complaining against the prosecution by the provincial government because it was prosecuting their publication on hate speech and hate writings and, which violated the press code.
Who do you think those two?
There could not be anything else other than Apte and Godse, because for the last 1 year, their publication was being fined and penalized by the provincial government for provocative and hate writings over there. And the Kapoor Commission was submitted a whole synopsis of articles and editorials in the Hindu Rashtra and the Agrani to substantiate that. And all the threats that were made to Gandhi and the hate against him and the violence and the communal writings of Godse and everything, it was all cited in the Kapoor Commission's report. So there is no possibility of those two people, whom Maniben told the Kapoor Commission that had come to meet Sardar Patel, being anybody other than Godse and Apte.
Could better communication between the Union Home Ministry and the Prime Minister's office have led to a different story? One that didn't involve Gandhi being shot dead. What could have been done better? What were the gaps? Tushar, between the first attempt on Bapu on January 20th, 1948, and the actual killing on the 30th of January, there seems to have been no communication between the PMO and the Union Home Ministry on the investigation into the first attempt. So there seems that's an odd thing, isn't it? And if there was, do you think Bapu could have been saved?
It's very odd that there was no communication between the Home Ministry and the PMO's office, or there was no questions from the PMO to the Home Ministry also, because one of the reasons cited for the dispute between the rift between Sardar Patel and Pandit Nehru was Sardar Patel often complaining about Nehru superseding him and going and ordering his ministry and staff in his ministry without going through the proper channels of, you know, going via the Home Minister. And he also complained about that to Bapu. Even on the 30th, when Bapu held the first meeting with Sardar Patel to pacify him and reason with him that the rift between the Prime Minister and the Home Minister was harmful to the government and the country, and he was brokering a peace package for them, and he was supposed to meet Panditji after the prayer meeting to convince him also and give him the same message. The complaint that Sardar Patel made was that I have nothing against Jawahar. There was a lot of affection between the two. But the fact that Pandit Nehru, the Prime Minister, used to circumvent the Home Minister and deal with the Home Ministry on his own was something that irritated the Home Minister. And yet, between the 20th and the 30th, there is no instance of the PMO asking Sanjeevi or any Home Ministry official about the progress on the investigation on the bomb attack on Bapu. It's as if suddenly the Prime Minister and the PMO discovered that they were not supposed to interfere in the affairs of the Home Ministry and things, which is very surprising. And here, for even one iota of an instance, I personally don't believe that either the Prime Minister or the Home Minister could be involved in the conspiracy of the
murder. I think the question really was that had there been that communication, do you think Gandhi could have been saved?
I think if there was a kind of pressure built up of that sort, the police might have been much more attentive and alert and efficient in their process. It felt as if, and because if you look at it, between the 20th and the 30th, Sardar was also away from the capital on official work on many occasions. And so it was possible that the police also realized that our bosses are not bothered, so why should we bother about it also? And that this was a... And one of the things that the police kept telling the Kapoor Commission, which also is very significant to establish why they were so lackadaisical in their work, was they kept complaining that the murderers did not play fair. In other terms, they did not play cricket.
The murderers did not play cricket. How do you explain?
You know, like the cricket is a gentleman's game and you're supposed to play it with all the rules and the traditions and obey them and you play it that way, in that spirit. And they said, you know, after failing, how could they come back within 10 days? It's cheating, you know. Who expects them to come back? We thought maybe there'll be an attempt, but 6 months down the line, 1 year down the line. And they should also have played fair, no, with us. How dare they come back in 10 days?
Shocking. But Tushar, let me come back to the theme that keeps rising again and again in the conversation, which is Savarkar. And, you know, what was the evidence? Now we're talking about hard evidence here, not just the linkages, the fact that people knew each other. What was the evidence that Savarkar was involved in the killing? Or was there any in the first
place? There was a lot of circumstantial evidence to point out Savarkar's involvement.
But that's circumstantial.
I'll tell you how that was. The entire prosecution's case in the Gandhi murder trial was based upon Badge's testimony as the approver. After his arrest, Badge became an approver and he gave a confessional statement to Nagarwala based on which everybody else was arrested and the investigations were carried out and the entire prosecution's case was built up on that. Now, one of the provisions of the law states that to substantiate a statement of the approver, two independent evidences also have to be established in court in the trial, which would support the accusation of the approver for the court to be able to find the accused guilty. So the prosecution created the whole chain of evidences against everybody. And if you look at the defense, apart from Savarkar, everybody else's, all the other accused, the defense was very lackadaisical also. It felt as if there was an understanding that in return for one murder, we are giving you four whom you can convict, five you can convict. And the entire defense team swung into action when it was time to defend Savarkar.
That's a very startling
it's
accusation.
It's not an accusation. You read the entire trial report, which is documented, and you'll see anybody can, even a lay person can notice the fact that the entire defense committee was oriented to safeguard Savarkar. And all those people who they needed to save so that they could save Savarkar were saved by them. And it was like a quid pro quo, ki we're giving you two accused to be convicted for one murder. So, you know, hisab kitab chukta.
Yeah, but Tushar, that's still not evidence. What was the evidence that was there against Savarkar?
Yeah, I'll come to the evidence. So, Badge told the police that on the 14th and then on the 17th, they had gone to Savarkar Sadan and met Savarkar. On one occasion, he was made to stand outside and Nathuram and Apte went inside, ostensibly to show the explosives and weapons gathered for the attack on the 20th.
Badge said that.
Badge told the police. Then he said on the 17th, before Apte and Godse departed for Delhi, he, along with Kishtaiya and Apte and Godse, drove up to Savarkar Sadan and they all got down and Kishtaiya was asked to stand by on the pavement. Badge and the three of them entered Savarkar Sadan and Badge was asked to wait in the ground floor sitting room. And Godse and Apte went up to the first floor, which was a living suit of Savarkar. And after 5 minutes, all three of them, along Savarkar, Nathuram Godse and Vinayak Apte, came down the stairs and he saw Savarkar blessing Apte and Godse and then look at Badge and from far bless him also. And then the three of them departed. And in the cab, Apte told Badge that Tatya Ravani sangitle ki ata Gandhi che 100 varsha sampnar ata apla kaam yashasvi honar ani aplyala aashirvad dila hai yashasvi hon ya. Which means that Savarkar in the Marathi speaking people was referred always as Tatya Rao, father's elder brother, out of respect. So Apte told Badge that Tatya Rao has said that now Gandhi's 100-year age is over and he will be finished and he has blessed us with the blessing that we should succeed and come back. This was also narrated by Badge to Nagarwala as his approver statement. So Badge gave these two points of reference. He also revealed that on 19th of January, Apte booked a call to the number which was listed in the directory as the number phone number of Savarkar Sadan from the Hindu Mahasabha office in Delhi, asking, you know, those days there used to be a system of the booking calls for PP, specified person kind of thing. And if that specified person was not available, the operator would ask you whether you want to still continue with the call or cancel it. So Apte booked the call and the PP named in that call was Kasar, who was Savarkar's assistant and bodyguard at Savarkar Sadan, who lived at Savarkar Sadan. The police established the fact that the call was booked to the number of Savarkar Sadan. They also established the fact that it was booked in the name of Damle or Kasar. Damle was also his personal assistant. Now, you must remember the call was booked in Delhi. So a Punjabi-speaking operator had booked the call. And in that time, I'm sure you must remember, operators used to sit with slips and pencils and they would note down the number and the PP if there was anybody and the calling party and things on a slip, which would later on be entered into a register and then the thing. And many a times, because out of boredom or while writing, in a writing mistake, they would erase things and scratch it out and rewrite or doodle on the chits and things. The chit that the police produced in court as evidence had a lot of erasers on it and scribblings on it and doodling on it. And one of the things was that Dalal was mentioned and then it was cancelled out and corrected to Damle. And things like that had been done. So when that evidence was brought in front of the court, Bhopatkar, who was defending Savarkar, only pointed out these discrepancies. He says there's so much cancellation and eraser and all that. How can we believe that this is true evidence? And so he managed to create doubt about that evidence produced in court. Then there was an even more strong evidence in court, a witness called Shanta Modak, who was a Marathi film and stage actress who was in the same train with Apte and Godse when they were traveling from Pune to Mumbai on the 14th. And Apte got friendly with her. He offered her his seat and started chatting her up. And she noticed that there was a silent man who was a partner with Apte. And when they got off, Apte offered to drive Shanta. But her brother was coming to pick her up in a car. And she said, "Where are you going?" So he said, "We're going to Shivaji Park." She said, "I'm also going to Shivaji Park. And my brother has a vehicle. Why don't you join us? I'll drop you off." And Apte told her, "We want to go to Savarkar Sadan." And she said, "I'm his neighbor. So I'll drop you off at the Savarkar Sadan." And she dropped him off at the Savarkar Sadan. And then they did goodbyes and things. And they drove off and Apte and Nathuram entered Savarkar Sadan. On hearing of the murder, and after Badge's statement to the police, Nagarwala contacted Shanta Modak and inquired about it, and she made a clean breast of the whole thing. She said, "Yes, this is what had happened on the 14th, and these were the people, and I dropped them off at Savarkar Sadan, and then we left after saying goodbye." The defense again sprang into action, and he said, "We accept the fact that she dropped them off outside Savarkar Sadan, but she doesn't, in her statement, she has not said that she saw them going into Savarkar Sadan or meeting Savarkar. Just seeing, dropping them off outside Savarkar Sadan doesn't establish the fact." Which is true, legally it is true. But then, when you want to get off at Savarkar Sadan and when you tell somebody that we are going to Savarkar Sadan, that means you are going to Savarkar Sadan. It doesn't mean that we are getting off at Savarkar Sadan and then going to Balmohan Vidyalaya. But legally speaking, enough doubt was created in the minds of the judge to say that the prosecution hasn't established beyond doubt that Shanta, the witness, saw them going into Savarkar Sadan and meeting with Savarkar. And so these two very crucial evidences were very easy for the defense to raise doubts on. And Savarkar was not, you must remember this, that Savarkar was not declared not guilty. He was released because the evidence produced against him was not sufficient to convict him. There is a very big difference between
them. Absolutely.
The two.
But was there an appeal then against his release?
Very surprisingly, after he was acquitted by the Red Fort, in the Red Fort trial on these grounds, the government did not appeal his acquittal when the appeal was made in the High Court. In the Punjab High Court. If the Punjab High Court was to again hear it, maybe the police would have had time to provide more information about it. And you must remember the fact that when the investigation into the murder was happening, Nagarwala, accompanied by the Commissioner of Police and B.G. Kher, had gone to Delhi and they briefed Sardar Patel on why Savarkar needed to be questioned and arrested in the murder conspiracy. And Sardar Patel very bluntly told them, he said, "If you think that by arresting Savarkar you will earn brownie points with the government, you're mistaken. We are not going to sort of reward you for doing that. You arrest him only if you're sure that you can get him convicted." And all three of them assured Sardar Patel that the overwhelming evidence that they had against Savarkar was irrefutable and he would not be able to escape conviction. And yet when you look at the Red Fort trial, you will notice that the prosecution's case against Savarkar was the weakest. They did not produce. And then the startling revelation again happens in the Kapoor Commission. Now, you must remember that when the Kapoor Commission was constituted and it started its inquiries, Savarkar was dead. He had died, his parts passed away. So he was no longer that iconic Hindu leadership anymore. And there was no reason to save him. And at the Kapoor Commission's inquiry, both Damle and Kassar have not only alluded to all the previous connections of Nathuram and Apte to Savarkar, but also revealed to the Kapoor Commission that post 20th, they remembered Nathuram and Apte meeting Savarkar on a couple of occasions. The last being 27th of January, before they left for Delhi on their way back. Now, you must remember, this becomes a very important evidence. You asked me for evidence. I cannot give you evidence apart from what was revealed at the Kapoor Commission. But circumstantially, remember one thing. Till the 27th, Nathuram and Apte do not have a reliable murder weapon. And that's their main worry. They're saying, we'll murder him, but we need a gun. And they are unable to get a gun. So the last resort, if we are to believe that they met Savarkar on the 27th, is that they would have said, we'll ask for help from Tatyaram. That was the only reason. You see, they are now marked people. And as loyal Savarkarites, they would do it to their utmost to not implicate him. So they would avoid him at all costs. But if Savarkar's associates claim that they had met him, the only reason they could have met him was to ask him whether he can help them get weapons. And it's only after that they decide to go to Gwalior. And whom do they go to Gwalior to? Another loyal Savarkarite. And so it's very natural to assume that it was at that meeting that Savarkar would have said, you need a weapon, Parchure and Gwalior can help you. And Nathuram would have said, but I just fought with him, he won't entertain me. Savarkar could have told him, no, he's loyal to me, tell him I have asked. Now, to substantiate this, I will also say, because when they land up after midnight of the 27th, between the 27th and 28th, when they land up at Parchure's house in Gwalior, the first response of Parchure is, why have you come here? Get out. I don't want to see your face. I don't want to see your face. And yet, Nathuram convinces him and they are allowed access to him. And then, the most startling thing, Nathuram plainly tells him that we are going to go to murder Bapu, Gandhi, and we need a weapon. Will you help us? And Parchure helps them. The only reason for this could be that he allowed access was when Parchure asked Nathuram and Apte to vamos. They would have said that we are on an errand for Savarkar. And then the Savarkar loyalist would have said, okay, come in.
Where is this
recorded? This is also recorded in the investigation reports, because there were two witnesses who told the police of Nathuram and Apte's visit to Parchure Wada before the 30th. The two Tonga drivers from Gwalior station who had brought Nathuram and Apte to Parchure's house. And then Parchure made a confessional statement in detail to the police also, revealing everything about how. And then there was a startling parallel. Parchure had also bought a Sten gun, like Apte. And the police recovered that statement, Sten gun also. So all these things. And then you see, who is the other one who is acquitted by the courts? It's Parchure. So you see that there is a thread. And when you are a conspiracy theorist, you don't even need, you know, such striking evidences. You just conjure it up. But this is not conjured up. Yes, legally they may not be sound evidence, but in the whole scheme of things, when you see it, they are vital links to the entire conspiracy.
So, do we have an explanation of why there was no appeal against Savarkar release?
Well, there is a statement of Sardar Patel which was reported to by the socialists, who said that Sardar Patel was known to have said that since the partition, the Muslims are annoyed with the Congress, and now we cannot avoid to, afford to enrage the Hindus also. And at that time, when the reference was made to Hindus, it was generally the Savarna Hindus, because the others were not even considered.
You're referring to the high caste.
The high caste Hindus, the upper caste Hindus. And who were the upper caste Hindus? The Brahmins. And so that allusion was there, that we can't afford to lose their support.
This is a verified statement?
This is a reported statement.
This is not verified.
Verified in the sense that sources who heard in person Sardar Patel saying this have reported it in their writings and things. I don't know what could be more verified than that.
So here's my final question for this episode. Who benefited politically from Gandhi's death?
I think everybody benefited. The most benefit went to India as a nation. Because before Gandhi's death, India was on the verge of anarchy brought about by insanity. It was going insane with hate. The tornado or the inferno of violence was threatening to consume the nation. And the very idea of India was likely to be aborted at birth or stillborn kind of thing. And so the biggest benefit was for India as a nation. The idea of India survived only because of the sacrifice of Gandhi. And I'm strongly now of the opinion that this kind of death was wished upon himself by Gandhi. He had realized post-Calcutta, post-Bihar and Noakhali and post-Kolkata after independence, and finally post-Delhi.
You're referring to the riots.
The riots, the communal riots in India pre-partition and post-independence. Gandhi had realized that India can only be saved by shock therapy. And there couldn't have been a bigger shock than the sacrifice of Gandhi himself. And I very strongly believe that if you can will things for yourself, then Bapu willed this death for himself. So the biggest beneficiary was India. For 70 years after that death, the rabid element was kept in check. The sanity of India was kept in check. It was only post that period of 60 years that India came out of that shock and started once again hurtling into that insanity of hate and communal passions that we see the society. And today again, once more, we stand at the crux where the idea of India is likely to be sacrificed.
Thanks, Tushar. With that, we come to the end of part 4 of this All Indians Matter special series on Gandhi's assassination. There were several myths created around Gandhi, an attempt to somehow justify the killing. This effort continues today as an attempt is made to reveal his killers. What were those myths and what is the truth about them? We'll find out in part 5.